Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Fairy Godmother's Growth Guide, Whimsical Poems and Radical Prose for Self-Exploration, by Marissa McGrady, narrated by Marissa McGrady. Publisher's note: in this audio edition, you will hear references to a flowchart titled The Self-Worth Web, which is visible in the print and ebook formats of the book. Dedication. To you, my dear, you are the reason I'm here. Disclaimer: the suggestions and recommendations made in this book are based on the author's knowledge, experience, and opinions. The methods described in this book are not intended to be a definitive set of instructions. Other methods and materials may accomplish the same end results. Results may vary. There are no representations or warranties, express or implied, about the completeness, accuracy, or reliability of the information, products, services, or related materials contained in this book. The information is provided as is, to be used at your own risk. This book is not intended as a substitute for consultation with a licensed healthcare practitioner, such as your physician. Before you begin any healthcare program or make lifestyle changes in any way, please consult a physician or another licensed healthcare practitioner to ensure that the examples contained in this book will not cause any harm. If you or someone you know is suffering from addiction, depression, or other mental health issues, eating disorders, or the like, please seek initial medical attention. Where appropriate, identities have been obscured out of concern for privacy. Preface. What makes a body good or bad? Is it the same thing that makes a person good or bad? Are good and bad the only options? Can we be something else? Something in between? Who decides? Ultimately, my dear, you do. Don't fret. That's a good thing. These questions pained me when I was younger. I wanted someone else to give me the answers, preferably in a nice, neat, bulleted list. I wished a fairy godmother would wave their magic wand and poof, my pain into peace. But apparently, that's not how it works. We decide for ourselves. We all find and create our own answers to life's big questions, and those answers evolve as we evolve. It's tough to make sense of your mind, your body, and the world around you when everything constantly changes. Plans change, people change, places change. Just when you finally figure yourself and your life out, you change. The known reverts to the unknown. The unknown expands, and boom, you start over again at square one. That's a lot to handle for us humble humans, as powerful and magical as we are. If it's any consolation, I believe we prove our progress, not erase it, when we start over. Each time we go back to square one, we go back with more knowledge, experience, and perspective. We learn or realize something new each time we try, regardless of the outcome. If you're anything like me, you may not find that concept comforting right now. Perhaps you want a fairy godmother to poof your problems away too. If so, today's your lucky day. I can be your fairy godmother if you'll have me. I can wave my magic wand and clarify the chaos flying around about self-love, self-care, and those ever-intriguing, ever-irritating existential questions. I can make you a nice, neat, bulleted list of suggestions and advice based on my own lived experience, a fairy godmother's growth guide, if you will. And you can decide whether or not it resonates with you. I cannot answer the big questions for you, my dear, but I can work with you to help you find and create your own answers. We can work together to make life more magical. I won't sugarcoat things. I won't shy away from tough topics. I won't ask you to be anything or anyone other than you. You don't have to earn my love or support. You already have it. Just say the magic word, and we can begin. Pick whichever word you like. Any word can be magical if you intend it to be. That said, if you pick a word that might get you in trouble, perhaps you should whisper it under your breath instead of saying it out loud. Splendid. All right, we've got a lot to cover. Let's start with the basics. Have you heard those cheesy sayings about life, being yourself, and trying your best? You know yourself best. Your best is enough. Progress over perfection. They're all true. Cliché, overused, and misused at times, but true. Before you roll your eyes at me, I get it. I rolled my eyes at these sayings and the people who parroted them for 20 years. Well-intended folks often smushed these sentiments in with other, lesser sayings like look for the silver lining. Ick. That saying irks me. I don't know about you, but I didn't want to be told to look for a silver lining while my life unraveled around me. I wanted help. I wanted guidance. I wanted a genuinely empathetic response. Sometimes life sucks. It's okay to admit that. Even the most magical, positive beings face difficult days, weeks, months, and years. Yes, life can be beautiful, inspiring, and fun. It can also be painful, unpredictable, and exhausting. Acknowledging this duality does not make someone a pessimist. Perspective is a powerful tool, but it cannot replace our need to feel and express human emotions. Everyone grapples with grief, sorrow, and anger eventually. Even if all situations technically contain some kind of silver lining, forcing positivity into moments of active, genuine pain denies us part of our humanity, prevents us from regulating and processing pain, and takes optimism to an unhealthy extreme. Perhaps sayings about silver linings inherently include this subtext. I took most things literally as a teenager. I still take most things literally, which is funny considering how much I adore fantasy, magic, and make-believe. Most humans are walking contradictions. I'm no exception. Since the subtext wasn't spelled out, I found sayings about silver linings reductive and, frankly, ridiculous. My anger grew each time I sought support, only to be met with superficial niceties that dismissed my pain at best and invalidated it at worst. My heart shrank a size smaller with each new disappointment. When death, instability, and dysfunctional dynamics ravaged my life, I bristled at the mere thought of someone telling me to focus on the good. I wished I could. I knew things could be worse. Guilt gnawed at me every time someone scolded me for lacking gratitude. I appreciated the roof over my head, but I feared what occurred beneath it. Every day, I stared up at the roof as the walls caught fire, smoke filled my lungs, hot ash scorched my skin. I willed myself to focus on the good while everything around me burned, and I blamed myself when I failed to find silver linings amid the wreckage. Remember when I said I take most things literally, but I'm also guilty of contradictions? The last four sentences of this passage serve to demonstrate past instability and pain in my life. My house was not literally on fire. As I grew older, the raging, wrathful flames within me dulled to controlled, cranky coals. The heat and hurt still simmered, but I was exhausted. Apathy crept in. My teenage self didn't understand how or why the adults with all the freedom to live their lives autonomously wouldn't teach me how to live mine. I didn't understand why authority figures who had the power to police my behavior wouldn't tell me how to process my emotions so I could behave according to their expectations, responsibly, quietly, and peacefully. Who gave them that power anyway? If I had a dollar for every time I sincerely asked an adult why I should do what they told me to do, and they responded with, "because I said so," I'd have enough dollars to pay for therapy. I didn't want to be overwhelmed by fear, rage, and despair. Nobody does. I didn't want to get in trouble. I was a goody-two-shoes with anxiety. Getting in trouble vexed me. I had exceptional grades, led and excelled in extracurriculars, respected my curfews, kept in constant communication with the adults in my life, worked multiple jobs, and didn't dabble in illegal activities. I wanted what the adults wanted, to be trusted, to be left alone. So it agitated me to my core that they faulted me for things like my tone and disposition, no matter how well I followed the rules. Even if I said and did all the right things, they didn't like how I said and did them. It felt so unfair. Like an I'm going to stomp my sparkly silver shoes into the fairy forest floor, snap my magic wand over my knee, and shout, "Are you kidding me?" up at the stars level of unfairness. I resented most people who tried to help almost as much as I resented people who didn't. I found their advice insufficient. Each time someone coughed up strained sayings about silver linings in an attempt to console me, I withdrew deeper into avoidance and annoyance. I interpreted superficial support as a sign that adults didn't consider me worth their time and teachings. I worried I'd done something bad, or maybe not done enough good, to deserve their dismissal. I couldn't figure out what to do differently. I felt certain that the adults living and working in the real world knew how to self-regulate. Surely they knew how to handle things, like death, grief, and fear of the unknown, so why wouldn't they teach me how to do the same? I didn't realize the adults might not have all the answers either. We rely on information to make decisions and interact with others. Sometimes we act instantly on gut feelings. Sometimes we ruminate over all the possible paths forward for what feels like an eternity. In either instance, we often blame people, ourselves and others, for undesirable outcomes. We convince ourselves that we have all the information we need to get things right, and we grow angry, frustrated, sad, and confused when things go wrong. But we don't know what we don't know. We don't know the limitations and truth of what we do know. People are only ever partially to blame. Sometimes the issue lies with the available information. When we base our decisions on faulty or incomplete information, we can get undesired outcomes, The subjectivity of human perception and the relativity of the human experience complicate information's reliability. For example, let's say person A swears that drinking herbal tea is life-changing. Person A could be telling the truth, but that information might not help person B because the life-changing impact of drinking herbal tea may only be true relative to the conditions of person A's existence. Person A's lifestyle, body, and personal taste make herbal tea life-changing for them, but person B has their own unique lifestyle, body, and personal taste. Therefore, person A's assessment that drinking herbal tea is life-changing can be both true and untrue at the same time, because it's based on subjective conditions. This may seem obvious in this context, but you'd be surprised how often humans, me included, conflate subjective truths and objective truths and experience distress as a result. Person A didn't lie. Person A didn't do anything wrong. If we specified the exact nature and conditions for every piece of information we share and clarified the objectiveness or subjectiveness of its truth every time we shared it, our conversations would quickly convolute. Anyone in this hypothetical example who decides to drink herbal tea based on person A's experience might not get the outcome they desire, but that isn't person A's or anyone else's fault. The issue would be the relative, subjective truth of person A's lived experience and the incomplete nature of the information shared. We learn how to live based on what we know. Sometimes we're unaware that what we know is inaccurate, incomplete, subjective, or relative. We can't beat ourselves up for the outcomes of our choices without examining the information that informed our choices. I'm not saying get rid of accountability. We all make mistakes. To err is human. When we mess up, we should hold ourselves accountable and do our best not to repeat harmful behaviors, whether we intended harm or not. However, if we try to do something with good intentions and we still get unwanted or harmful outcomes, we ought to examine the information that informed our outcomes after we take accountability for them, but before we use them to justify self-hatred. The same idea applies to self-love. Self-love, self-care, and self-worth are all subjective, relative concepts. Anyone who claims that they can teach you about these concepts and consequently about yourself, without acknowledging the subjective, relative, and limited nature of their information should not be trusted. There is no singular objective truth about how to love and care for yourself. There is no right or wrong way to be you. Any guidance, steps, instructions, opinions, advice, or information offered about concepts like self-love is always limited, at least in part, by the lived experience and knowledge of the person offering it. No one knows you as well as you do. No matter how well someone knows or claims to know you, the secondary data they collect and possess about you by observing you can't contend with the data you collect and possess by living as you. This is where the first of those cheesy sayings comes into play. You know yourself best. You know your needs. You know your wants. You know your fears. You know even the unknowable, unconscious parts of yourself more than anyone else ever can. If you're shaking your head at me and saying, "But I don't know what I need. I barely know how to survive. I barely know what I did last Tuesday. I want someone to tell me how to do this. How do I love and care for myself? How do I deal with pain? How do I live?" I see you. I crave objective answers and instructions too. I know it might seem frightening, overwhelming, unreasonable, or even impossible to trust yourself, especially if someone or something has convinced you that your understanding of reality can't be trusted. But you do know yourself best. Therefore, you are the most qualified person to teach yourself how to live. I and many others can help you. We can offer you information and guidance, but you must teach yourself. You decide whether our information interests you. You consider and evaluate new perspectives, compare them to alternative perspectives, and decide which ones feel right for you. You practice new behaviors and determine what they can and can't provide for you. You've already been doing all this and living your life successfully up until today, whether you think so or not. Forget about external measures of success. You're here. You're alive. No matter who or what helped you, you sustained your life until this very moment. You continue to sustain your life with each passing word you hear. You, my dear, are maintaining your life right now, no matter how well or poorly you think you're doing it. While you were begging, searching, or waiting for someone to tell you how to live, you were already living, even if it's not exactly how you want to be living yet. The wonderful, magical thing about that is that we can change how we live at any moment. Structural and individual barriers make certain kinds of change challenging or difficult to access, but we can still exercise autonomy within those limitations in small but meaningful ways, and we will address that in this book. Self-worth is not just an internal concept. It's impacted by our external world and consequently by the world's injustices. We can still try something new. We can retry something old. You're listening to this book, for example. That was you trying something new. Maybe you went back to an old routine or preference recently after experimenting with a new one. You tried something new, evaluated how you liked it, and decided you preferred your original choice. You trusted yourself. You changed your mind. You exercised your autonomy. Only you know all the tiny details, actions, and thought processes that go into these seemingly mundane daily exercises of autonomy. You have the most accurate, comprehensive understanding of yourself and what it's like to live your life. You are the only qualified expert on you. You know yourself best, and we know that information impacts our decisions. As your fairy godmother, it's my solemnly sworn duty to provide the best supplemental information I can to help you decide how you want to live your life each day. It's not your fault if all the cheesy, optimistic ideas about life, growth, and self-love annoy you. They annoyed me too, because they're incomplete. They're relative, subjective, and open to interpretation. No one ever explained the exact nature, conditions, applications of, and contradictions between these ideas to me. They certainly didn't expand on the implications and limitations of these ideas in the wider world. But I will do my darndest to explain all these things to you based on my understanding of them. Let me emphasize the my in the previous sentence. My as in relative to me. My understanding and information are limited. My stories and examples are based on my lived experience, though I do my best to provide objective definitions for terms to make this text more cohesive and digestible. You decide whether my opinions, interpretations, and perspectives benefit you or not. I can advocate for why I think my ideas deserve consideration, but I can't decide whether you consider them. Only you can do that. I cannot be you, and I don't need to be. You're already doing a lovely job being you, my dear, and I'm busy being me. I cannot tell you exactly how to live your life, how to love and care for yourself, or what will work best for you specifically. Only you can assess and do that. I can be your fairy godmother. I can share all my poems and perspectives to help empower and inform you. I can offer you genuine empathy and share my stories about pain and growth so you know you aren't alone. I can tell you how I care for myself without judgment or expectation and how it helps me. I can tell you why self-care can't solve everything. I can tell you about the ways I messed up, what I learned from the experiences, and what I do differently now. I can show you how I make life magical for myself, but you must make your life magical. Other people, places, experiences, and resources can and will add to your magic, but only you can create and protect it. Only you can live your life. And you are the most qualified, capable person to do so. I pinky promise. Introduction. Life has inherent light. This light goes by many names. Some people call it a soul. Some people call it the self. Some people call it consciousness or energy. Whatever we call it, we collectively understand that it is the intangible, inherent something that distinguishes life from non-life. I call it light. What you call this intangible, inherent something, and how you prove, disprove, or define it is up to you. Your beliefs about life are your business. Your quality of life is my business. You made it my business when you chose this book, said the magic word, and made me your fairy godmother, if you listened to the preface, that is. If you didn't, don't worry. I'm still here and happy to help. I cannot tell you exactly how to live your life or why we're all here. Only you can answer those big questions for yourself. I can and will share my story and all I've learned about building sustainable, accommodating self-care practices and resilient self-worth. I hope to help you learn from my mistakes. I also hope to help lighten your heart. Before my tenure as a fairy godmother, I was a stuffy, sad person who thought art had to be serious or solemn to be valuable. What a bunch of phooey. Much like magic, art is what we make and believe it to be. I wrote rhyming poems to uplift and entertain you. I penned prose to empower you and expose you to new perspectives, and I sprinkled it full of fairy dust. Whether you listen to any of it or not is none of my business. You have my support either way. Do what feels right for you. I want you to trust yourself enough to decide what right means and to act on it, both in this context and throughout life. You can ask other people for input, but you determine whether something aligns with you and your values. I want you to love yourself enough to know you can change your mind and make mistakes too. Being wrong about something is not a moral failing. You're always free to learn and try again. There is no one-size-fits-all way to live life. We do our best to figure it out as we go. We learn, apply, and repeat. We tweak things until they work. We try new things, meet new people, and explore new places. Our beliefs evolve and solidify as we grow. We know that religion, spirituality, philosophy, and certain sciences carry different weight for different people. We recognize that what works for us may not make sense to someone else. We respect each other's autonomy because we know the struggle intimately. It's hard to understand yourself, especially when you're still trying to understand everything else. Galaxies, gods, family, pleasure, pain, it's a lot to take in all at once. No one asked us if we wanted to be born, at least not that we can remember. As far as we know, we just showed up one day, and we've all been trying to figure life out ever since. We know this about ourselves and each other. We get it. There are exceptions, unfortunately, but for the most part, we see each other human to human, person to person. We acknowledge each other and say, I'm doing my best, you're doing your best, and that's all there is. And we offer each other compassion within that. We make sense of our lives as we live them. We have to. It's all we can do. Why, then, is it not the same for self-love? Where did mainstream ideas and expectations about self-love come from, and why are so many of them superficial, unsustainable, and inaccessible? Why are genuine insecurities and negative emotions feared, shamed, and dismissed? How can anyone advocate for self-love without addressing self-hatred and its roots? How do multi-billion-dollar budget wellness and self-help industries manage to make us feel worse? Who benefits, or more so, profits, from that? Modern media oversimplifies self-love. The most freely, instantly accessible resources dominate and dictate popular narratives about our internal selves. These resources primarily exist online. Mass digital media outlets, social media influencers, and other online thought leaders often use self-love as a blanket term for a variety of concepts with differing definitions, like self-worth, self-esteem, and self-acceptance. They describe self-love as an emotion or positive feeling rather than as an awareness of yourself and your needs. They say you can achieve these loving feelings for yourself by treating yourself, buying your favorite flowers and chocolates, for example, without explaining that these singular acts of self-care do not serve the same purpose as sustainable self-care practices designed to help you meet your basic needs. Feelings fade and fluctuate. Temporary happiness derived from singular acts of self-care cannot create durable self-worth. Popular self-love narratives often leave these details out in favor of generalizations and toxic positivity. Toxic positivity is a flawed approach to emotional regulation that encourages people to ignore, suppress, or hide negative emotions. We'll chat more about this in chapters 2 and 3. These generalizations and toxic positivity, however well or ill-intended, can hurt and confuse people more than they help them. They hurt and confused me for over a decade. I hated myself for failing at self-love before I realized I wasn't the problem. The problem, which I will do my best to rectify for you in this book, was inaccurate and incomplete information. Our first thoughts. Self-love did not come naturally to me. Some folks talked about it when I was younger. No one modeled it. The most influential people around me deprecated, doubted, and/or neglected themselves. Many of them didn't know any better. They weren't taught how to care for and love themselves either. They cautioned me against following in their footsteps, but never took their own advice. They muttered, "Do as I say, not as I do," and forgot that children learn by imitation. Thus, the cycle continued. I listened to what they said, but observed what they did. I studied how they treated themselves, internalized how they treated me, and pondered the juxtaposition between their public and private behaviors. I watched, I listened, I mimicked, and learned. I grew up in the suburbs of a small southern city in America during the early 2000s. Local and national pop culture reinforced the behaviors and mindsets I observed around me. The ideal southern Christian woman ought to be slender and delicate. Little girls should be seen, not heard. Tabloids and magazine covers that compared best and worst beach bodies lined every grocery store checkout aisle. Talk show hosts wailed about weight gain and whispered about weight loss in the same breath. Hatred haunted every hall. At home, at school, at church, at the mall. I couldn't escape it, and as a tall, curvy, mentally ill girl with ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, I couldn't conform correctly either. Self-hatred became my natural inclination. It crept in quietly enough. The women in my life nitpicked my appearance until I learned what parts of me to hide. They frowned at baggy, worn clothes, but yelled if they saw too much skin or traces of my figure. The men in my life silenced me until I learned not to speak. They ridiculed me for being quiet and weird, but laughed when I tried to jump into conversations and ignored me when I asked questions. The contradictions exhausted me. I carved "I am always too much, but never enough" into every fiber of my being. I became equally scared of trying and not trying, so whenever I could, I froze. I grew into self-hatred. When I saw myself as a child, my first reaction was distaste. When I took on responsibilities, my heart pounded with panic. When I thought of my successes, unease washed over me that whatever fluke led to them would eventually be exposed. When I thought of my failures, my first reaction was smug, cognitively dissonant satisfaction. I was right to doubt myself. I felt irresponsible, unoriginal, unwanted, and destined for mediocrity. I didn't believe I was significant enough for anything better or worse. If you've had similar thoughts, perhaps self-love does not come naturally to you either. Whether by nature, nurture, or a combination of both, our immediate reactions to ourselves, the first conditioned thoughts we have about our identity, physicality, abilities, and value, are often cruel. My first thoughts ruled tyrannically for years. They sent me spiraling into tailspins of self-sabotage. That spiral looked like this. Step 1. Develop a new opportunity, a relationship, responsibility, etc. Step 2. Realize I partially control the outcome of the new opportunity. Step 3. Panic. Because my first thoughts tell me I cannot and will not do what I should do, whatever that means, with the portion of the new opportunity I control. Step 4. Panic some more, because my first thoughts tell me trusting someone or something else to handle the portion of the new opportunity that's out of my control is not safe, because rejection, change, failure, and the unknown are life-threatening evils, according to my traumatized ADHD brain. Step 5. Reject, abandon, avoid, and/or destroy the new opportunity. Step 6. Fulfill whatever prophecy my first thoughts of self-hatred foretold, that I can't do anything right, that I'm lazy and irresponsible, etc. The previous cycle impacted me every day. No thought process escaped the cycle's wrath. For example, did I want to make breakfast? Nope, not allowed. I could burn the house down. Did my employer want to promote me? No chance. I should quit before I destroy my employer's entire organization with my incompetence. No matter what happened, good or bad, my first thoughts could turn every situation into a problem, a reflection of my inadequacies, or a justification for some element of my self-loathing. The version of self-love I knew as a teenager and young adult never helped. It seemed insincere. How was I supposed to create positive feelings about someone I feared, didn't trust, and didn't respect? Myself. All the affirmations and journaling exercises felt hollow. Looking in the mirror and affirming beauty you don't see and value you don't recognize feels like a farce. My inability to create what I thought was self-love, positive feelings about myself, despite my efforts and dedication, deepened my lack of self-trust and self-confidence. My first thoughts overpowered me. Everything I did to fix them fed them. I've been in therapy since I was a kid. Who needs to be in therapy for over 10 years? I filled journals with affirmations and blew paychecks on face masks, but my self-hatred persisted. Who fails at self-love? My anger and fear grew. I didn't want to be this way. and I worked hard to try to change. I went to school, got a job, and did everything else I thought would lead to success.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?